I'm Kayla Branch.
And I'm Nuria Martinez-Keel. You're listening to The Source.
Thanks for joining us as we discuss the Oklahomans' most impactful stories with the reporters who wrote them. This week,
a tragic event takes two young lives and more.
And a member of the Central Park Five comes to Oklahoma.
Two students from Moore High School were killed and four were injured after a pickup truck drove into track runners two blocks away from the school on Monday. 17-year-old Rachel Freeman was killed at the scene. 16-year-old Yuridia Martinez died from her injuries on Tuesday. The truck driver, Max Leroy Townsend, is in police custody.
We have reporter Tim Willert on the phone with us. Tim's at home right now calling in because of the snow day. But Tim, you've been doing a lot of the on-the-ground reporting from the scene in Moore. What can you tell us about what happened during the crash on Monday?
Well, you know, I was in the office Monday, and I actually, my wife told me about what had happened, and I rushed down, and I got there about 4:30, so I think I got there about an hour after it happened. But what I saw was a street with, you know, dented cars. It looked like most of the injured students had been taken away, but just a lot of confused, you know, saddened people, you know, kind of outside their doors. There was a heavy police presence there, so it was roped off. But, you know, I just went to work trying to find out, you know, what people saw or what people heard, and talked to, you know, authorities. Fortunately, I know the school's security and safety director, who I've worked with over the years, and he was, you know, he helped me out, and so did Sergeant Jeremy Lewis from the Moore Police Department. But from what I could tell, it sounds like a lot of students took part in after the tragic crash. Some of these kids told me that this guy was going 90 miles an hour when he came around the corner up the street from the football field. It was east of the football field, probably two or three blocks up Main. I guess the theme, what I heard over the next 24 hours or so, was just how willing other students were to help, to assist with the injured, to comfort them, to render first aid.
We've got a lot of really special people that live and go to school here in Moore, and to see, come around the corner, to see kids and coaches giving first aid and helping their classmates and their students. We live in a really good community.
While other students took off after the truck, who, you know, I'm told the suspect was impaired and kept driving. He didn't stop. So students hopped into action right away. So obviously there were two students who were killed. One died the next day, and there's still one student in the hospital who is in critical condition with a head injury.
So what do we know at this point about the pickup truck driver and what led up to the crash?
Well, police haven't been able to give us a motive for what he did. I do know his name is Max Leroy Townsend, and he has a lengthy criminal past. He's been arrested several times for DUI, for alcohol related incidents, and you know, he was arrested on multiple complaints, including first degree manslaughter. Apparently, when his truck finally came to a stop, about four or five blocks from the crash site, some neighbors overheard him saying, my son, they said he appeared to be visibly impaired. They weren't sure whether he was drunk or on drugs.
He was acting very erratic. He didn't try to run away. The kids took the keys out of his truck, and he went over and sat down by his truck, and I stayed with him till the police showed up.
Did he say anything to you?
He just kept saying, I lost my son. And he said he's going to see his sister who lived up the road, and that's about it.
He looked freaked out, but I don't think he realized what was going on. But he did look, because the kids who caught him were like, hey, you hit kids? So he was confused, looking for his cell phone, and so he was almost in shock.
Apparently, his 29-year-old son, 28-year-old son, had been killed in a car accident that he apparently caused the night before. So that would explain, I guess, that. But as far as a motive or why he did it, we don't know at this point.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of what I've heard from, you know, some folks. I feel like a lot of people have been talking about this. It's come up in conversation a lot, and that's something that has been mentioned. That, you know, his son had died the night before, and so people have been speculating that maybe his distress there had something to do with this. You know, you also covered the vigil that Moore High School hosted Tuesday night. So talk a little bit about that event and, you know, what the message was they were talking about there.
Well, the main gym at Moore High School holds about 3,000 people. And I would say it was at least half full. I would say there were at least 1,500 people there. It was interesting because the vigil didn't last long. It was about 20 minutes. And, you know, the choir sang, and Rachel Freeman's pastor, Rachel was the track athlete who died Monday. Her pastor spoke, as did another pastor. So there was, the emphasis was on hope and perseverance and how you get through something like this. And a lot of prayer.
Things like this make us press in further to loving people around us. And that's what I want to challenge us with tonight. As we move from this place tonight, let us infuse more of God's love into this world.
Moore has witnessed, has experienced this kind of, you know, tragedy before, back, you know, with the tornado. The kids at the elementary school were killed in that tornado, and so they've dealt with this kind of, you know, sudden tragedy before, and so one more time they're in this situation.
Yesterday we had a bad day. That won't define us. Moore's had a lot of bad days, and it hasn't defined us. It's made us stronger, and that's what we need right now. We need each other. We need everyone to work harder for each other so that we can represent those two young ladies and those kids who were in the accident, because that's who we are. We are more.
And so everybody's just kind of leaning on everybody and, you know, loving on each other, you know, and just trying to keep the faith. And that was kind of the message there, that you can get through this, and you know, a lot of people are having a hard time dealing with this right now, which is why they've had extra counselors and such out at the school. But, you know, it was just a short, it wasn't heavy on talk. It was more about prayer and song and just you know, helping each other get through this tragedy.
Right, Tim, and you're totally correct that Moore is no stranger to tragedy. When seven elementary students died in May 2013 at Plaza Towers Elementary in a major tornado. So, Tim, thank you so much for all your reporting. I know it's a heavy subject, but we appreciate you coming on and talking about that.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're joined by sports columnist Jenny Carlson. Jenny, you wrote about Rachel Freeman and Yuridia Martinez this week. What did you learn about these two girls?
Yeah, these were two athletes from Moore High School that I hadn't heard their names before. Mm-hmm. The accident happened on Monday. But both athletes that were pretty heavily involved with the sports scene at Moore. Rachel, a senior, she had transferred to Moore her sophomore year, actually had to sit out from varsity competition a year, but she was there for distance running, so cross country and track were her two big things. So these last 2 years, she's been a big part of those two programs, and was actually going to sign a college letter of intent on Wednesday to go to Ouachita Baptist University in Arkansas. So a runner who'd been fairly well accomplished. And then Yuridia Martinez, she was younger, she's just a sophomore, actually a volleyball player, was kind of her calling card. She was running, but was more about staying in shape during the off season, as a lot of athletes do. They get involved in multiple sports to kind of feed that obsession sport, and hers was really volleyball. She had a twin sister, and they both played volleyball, and really, obviously, because of her involvement in a couple sports, not only is the track team that is feeling the effects of her law, losing her, but the volleyball family at Moore High School has also been very affected by her death. So just so many fingers to this tragedy when you start to, you know, talk to people and find out, even though Rachel only 17, Yuridi only 16, they really had impacted a lot of people in their young lives.
Yeah, and I loved the story that you wrote on Rachel and talking with who the person who might have been her college coach. Kind of walk us through that. I mean, the timing on that, just a couple days before she was going to sign her college letter of intent.
Yeah, I mean, just a tragic situation. And in fact, because of our snow, Moore, like many other schools, had to delay their ceremony to celebrate all their signees on Wednesday. And so that's actually been pushed back to next week, next Wednesday, a week from when they would have actually had it. The athletes will have already signed, but they're already thinking about what they can do to honor Rachel in specific during that time. Obviously, her memorial, her funeral has been scheduled already. But so she was really interested in running, distance running in college. And one of the main reasons why she transferred to Moore was she wanted to be in a bigger school with a program where maybe she could be seen by some recruiters. And it just so happened that the coach at Ouachita Baptist, Steve Guyman, who actually went to college here in the Oklahoma City area, he's actually from Oklahoma Christian. So again, I talk about those fingers of this tragedy reaching a lot of places. But he moved to Ouachita Baptist actually just in the last year and was told by the university president that they really wanted to expand their women's cross country and their women's track. So that meant getting a lot of athletes. He was out trying to find a lot of recruits, and so sent letters to a lot of different coaches and programs and said, hey, do you have anybody interested in running in college? And it just so happened one of those letters went to Moore High School, and it ended up in Rachel's hands, and she called him, sight unseen, had never been to Ouachita Baptist, to hear him tell it, really didn't know anything about Ouachita Baptist. But as soon as he started to talk to her, he basically said, this is a kid that I knew I wanted in my program. You know, whether she would have been their top runner, a varsity runner, he just knew from her personality and the way she engaged that she was the type of person that you wanted your other runners to be around. Just very engaging, you know, very positive. And so he knew right away he wanted her. Then he had to convince her to join the program. So went on a visit and back in the fall, early winter. And after a few weeks of considering Ouachita, she called him back and said she wanted to join the team. So yeah, she would have made that official on Wednesday. And I know that there are a lot of people that had a chance to meet Rachel in Arkadelphia, which is where Ouachita is, and they're very affected by this too, because even in that limited time, they really had been impacted by her and her attitude, her spirit.
Yeah, and you talked to several people for your story on Yuridia Martinez. What did people seem to remember the most about her?
Yeah, sort of in a similar vein. She was just a really energetic, happy person. She spent most of her elementary years, even into middle school, attending Sacred Heart School, which is a small Catholic school, about three miles, 10 minutes or so south of downtown Oklahoma City, right next to Mount St. Mary. If you know where the mount is, it's kind of a landmark in that area of the city. But she spent several years there and talked to the principal, Adriana Garza, who was Yuridia's second grade teacher. Then she became the school principal. So then she became her principal for many years. And she just remembered that Yuridia was and her twin sister, Yuridia is the younger of the two girls, but she just remembers both of them being constantly on the move, you know, always active, often outside. And just a really helpful mentality. You know, there were just a variety of stories that Principal Garza, you know, heard as she, I mean, obviously there are a lot of teachers still at the school, even some students that knew the Martinez twins because, you know, they only left a couple years ago, only graduated from the eighth grade there at Sacred Heart a couple years ago. So a lot of people really, you know, got to know them over the years. And so, you know, they told stories of, you know, not huge things, but just an insight into that helpful nature of, you know, if there was the eighth grade, for example, when the twins were in eighth grade, they decided to throw a party for their cafeteria workers. And Yuridia, right there in the middle, wanted to help, wanted to be involved. You know, a small thing maybe in the grand scheme of things, but in the life of her schoolmates, other people at the school, just really a person that was always helpful, always willing to do, and again, she was either helping people or running around enjoying sports, it sounded like.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, as a reporter from your perspective, and I think our listeners will be curious as well, how do you even begin to, you know, learn everything that you have learned about these two girls? I mean, and what did the families think if you've reached out to them or these folks? Were people wanting to talk? I mean, it sounds like these girls had really positive stories with their lives that maybe people wanted to share, maybe they didn't. But just from your perspective as a reporter, how did you go about finding out this information?
Yeah, and you know, obviously, if you read the stories, that people probably saw that we did have a statement from Yuridia's family. They released a statement. My days have all run together on Wednesday, I guess. She died of her injuries on Tuesday, but Wednesday released a statement. But we really haven't had a chance to hear yet from the families, from the Freemans or from the Martinez, at least in person. And I think that's to be understood. I mean, this was obviously a total shock to them and, you know, the whole Moore High School community. But I do think that the time will hopefully come where the addition of their voices and stories can be talked about. But I did, through a couple different channels, you know, at least let the families know that the door is open. You know, I think that in instances like this, you know, some people they want to share right away. We unfortunately had a situation in the fall. Peter Webb, a football player at Southwest Covenant, who was injured in a game and he died. And we found out that his family, his parents, were actually wanting to talk. They were wanting to share in those, you know, days after that accident. And, you know, in the same vein, we wanted to basically let it be known that the door's open to these two families. And, you know, at this point, we haven't heard that they're ready to talk yet. But I hope at some point, and I think at some point they probably will, because, you know, it seems like not only do their daughters have great stories, but, you know, I would venture that for their children to be the way that they are, that their families have some really fantastic stories to tell as well, and examples probably for the rest of us. So, you know, then in trying to, you know, have that connection with the families when you're not sure if that's going to happen, from my perspective as a reporter, I'm just trying to find anyone else that I think might have had connections and long-term connections, obviously not to the extent of their families, but, you know, those coaches, those administrators. And, you know, just really trying to, you know, ask them, you know, what did you know about these girls? How did you come to know them? What were those moments that stand out in your mind from, you know, your time with them? And so, you know, some fun stories, for example, Yuridia's club volleyball coach, she and her sister played a couple months of a volleyball season at a Premier Volleyball is the name of it, OK Premier Volleyball. And her coach said the very first day of practice, she, you know, she's going through introducing herself, getting to know the girls, and she realizes she's got twins. And she just up and tells them, I'm never going to remember which one's which. So who's older? Okay, you're twin one. And it was Yuritsa, the older of the twins, and Yuridia was the younger. Okay, you're twin two. And basically from then on, that's how everybody knew them on the team.
Twin one and twin two.
Twin one and twin two. So from the bench, the girls would yell, come on, twin one. Come on, twin two. So they didn't even go by their names from that moment on that team. So just some fun moments and some you know, memories that I think people were are thinking about now in these days, you know, since we lost both of these girls.
Yeah, and so when we think about what this
team of cross-country runners were doing at the moment when this crash happened. If my understanding is right, it's pretty common to see students and cross-country runners running alongside roadways or on sidewalks. It's just kind of part of their routine. Is that right to say?
Yeah. And so this was the distance running group of the track team and a lot of cross-country runners. Exactly. You're exactly right. And they had finished up. I talked with the AD at Moore yesterday, and they have their athletic period as their sixth period, which a lot of schools have an athletic period within their school day. They had their track practice within the football stadium, and then at the east end of the football stadium, it kind of opens up and goes into a neighborhood, which Main Street is the east-west street that runs just to the south of the football stadium at Moore High School. They were exiting basically into a neighborhood area. There's the main part of the school is to the west of the football stadium. So there's, I think it's Eastern Avenue that runs right in front of the school. And that's a really heavily trafficked area. But yeah, so they were exiting out of that area, sort of at the back side of the stadium, onto a sidewalk, and it's a street, the stretch of Main Street, the AD Chad Mashburn, who actually used to be the track and distance coach, so he has some knowledge of this. He told me that that stretch of street and sidewalk, it's about 3/4 of a mile from there at the back end of the stadium out to Bryant Avenue. And it's through a very, neighborhood, houses, quiet area. And they would basically run out there as sort of a cool down. Most of us think running a mile and a half is probably not cooling anything down. But they would run out to Bryant and then come back, and that would be the end of their workout. And that was what they were doing on Monday. They had basically finished up probably some sprints and some strength workout and those sorts of things. And they were just sort of in that last portion of their practice day. And over years and years, it sounds like hundreds, maybe even more, athletes from Moore High School have used that very road, that very sidewalk to run. I mean, it's just part of the fabric of what they do. And yeah, and I think that is a very common, when you're talking about distance running, it's really hard. You can run on a track, you can obviously do that, but there just comes a point where, you've got your sprinters working and your, all these hurdlers running, and there's just only so much space at these bigger schools. And so to sort of alleviate some of that, then your distance runners will sometimes go out, run on sidewalks, maybe country roads at the smaller schools. Yeah, I think this is something that, literally hundreds, if not more, kids at Moore and many other schools have done something similar over the years. And, we've just not had anything approaching this. And so I don't think it was that anybody was doing anything out of the ordinary, anything crazy dangerous. It was just a tragedy that happened. And unfortunately, these were the kids that were involved.
Yeah, and just some parting thoughts here. How have you seen the two teams, and like you mentioned, volleyball, and then the track and field, and the coaches? How are people trying to process this and move forward?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a work in progress. I mean, you're talking about with volleyball, they're a fall sport, so some of those girls are likely together on other teams. They may be playing some club ball, but for the most part, they're not necessarily all together. But you do have, obviously, that track team that's now practicing as a spring sport. And I think that it's going to be a work in progress to figure out how are they individually coping, how are they collectively coping, and what do they need to do? What do the adults, the coaches, the administrators, what do they need to do to aid that along? And it's been, I talked with Chad Mashburn, as I mentioned, the athletic director at Moore, and we talked on Wednesday, which was the first of the snow days this week. Most school districts, including Moore, are in a second one on Thursday. And he said that he didn't know how things were going to be as far as, people being apart on Wednesday. I think, in some regards, I think the adults might have needed to catch their breath a little bit, and maybe, recharge a little bit. But and maybe the kids to some degree, too, needed a little separation. But he was really looking forward to having them all back together on Tuesday. They actually brought all of the teams, all the spring teams at least, together in one room so they could all kind of talk through where they were at that moment. But there will be some rough emotions. I mean, there's going to be that first practice. There's going to be that first meet. There's going to be all sorts of firsts that they didn't ever think would be a big deal. And now they will be. And so how are they going to move forward? And then the question of, do they use that same route for all those distance runners? Chad said that they weren't quite to the point of knowing what they were going to do. So I think a lot of questions still to be answered. A lot of it is day to day, but I think when you're dealing with grief, and I think when you're dealing with it, again, both individually and as a collective, I think sometimes you just have to be very responsive to what is happening in the moment.
Definitely. Great. Well, thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Joining us next is the Oklahoman's religion editor, Carla Hinton. Carla, we're glad to have you back on the podcast. Thanks for coming back and joining us.
So you recently attended an event at Oklahoma Christian University where Raymond Santana spoke about his experience being part of the group known as the Central Park Five. So just a quick recap for listeners. In New York City in 1989, police brought in five teenage boys of color and questioned them in connection to a brutal beating and rape of a jogger in Central Park. The teens were convicted of the crime and served many years in jail before the actual attacker came forward. So the men were exonerated almost 20 years ago, and their case was settled just a few years back. So that's kind of a recap of who the Central Park Five are.
Right. So to start here, why did Mr. Santana come to speak at Oklahoma Christian?
Okay. Well, every year for the last, I want to say it's their sixth year doing this, Oklahoma Christian has what they call History Speaks. It is a civil rights lecture series that they have during Black History Month, and their record of presenting amazing speakers is phenomenal. They've always had someone really good, someone really relevant. I know in the past they've had Emmett Till's cousin, who was with him when he got taken by a white mob and killed. They have had Claudette Colvin, lots of other civil rights leaders, Andrew Young, you know, who marched with Martin Luther King. So they've always had really good speakers to come. And so that's why he was here. He was their History Speaks presenter this year.
Right. And so can you talk about the event? Describe the crowd. What were people's reactions to this story?
Well, the first thing I can tell you, so I have not gone to every one, but I've gone to probably more than half of the six or seven. Like I said, it may be six or seven. And this time, so I got there about 15 minutes before the doors opened. The doors were going to open at 30 minutes ahead of time. I got there 15 minutes ahead of time. My son got there almost an hour ahead of time, and there were already people in line. Three long lines. Because of the cold weather, they let people come in and form lines. And so I thought, wow, I misjudged it because I was thinking, okay, I'll be okay if I get there about 45 minutes ahead of time. No, the lines were already there. And keep in mind, this is a free event. They do this for free because they want to engage the community with, you know, complex dialogue and to have some, you know, conversations about things that the community needs to have and says it wants to have. But anyway, so it was a very diverse crowd, racially, also different generations. I went with my son, who's in his 20s. So I saw lots of that, you know, people with parents of all different ages, that sort of thing, husband and wives, things like that. I think there was a couple of church groups that came. So there were lots of people that were interested in hearing Santana's story.
Definitely. And what was his story? What was his message that he gave to attendees?
Well, one of the things that's real interesting about him, in recent years, people have been talking about what happened to the so-called Central Park Five because of two different films. One was a PBS special by Ken Burns, and a lot of people know Ken Burns, the director. Most of his work is amazing, all of it, I think it is. And then also, more recently, the Netflix miniseries called When They See Us, which I just saw recently. I didn't see it on purpose because everybody that I knew, most minorities that I knew, including my family members, came away from it, you know, angry. They said it was great, but it made me cry. I was angry. And I thought, do I want to do that? No. So I didn't see it at first, but I did see it because I knew that I was going to this right. event, and I thought I better see it. And I'm glad I did, because there's a lot of information that I wouldn't have gleaned from, you know, newspaper articles and just watching videotapes and things like that. But his message, so they were wrongfully convicted. They were, a lot of people came in knowing what happened in the miniseries. And he said that most of the stuff in the miniseries was really true, that they talked to the director, Ava DuVernay, who is the director and producer of the film Selma, mm-hmm. which was a lot of people enjoyed that movie. And he said that she talked to them and got their stories, and that's where they got everything. But it's just the story. He just kind of explained his part of it. You know, he was a young Hispanic boy, 14 years old, not been in trouble or anything. And he had headed to the park, not directly, but he was supposed to be going to a party that night. It was a holiday weekend, and they could stay out a little later. You know, his dad said, "No, go to the park." Well, so they were going to a party first, and then they met up with another group, and they ended up going to the Central Park. He had never been in Central Park. He didn't know how to navigate it or anything. The day after April 19th, so there was a white woman jogger who was beaten and raped in the park, April 19th, 1989. So the day after, I guess somewhere in the wee hours or something, he got pulled in. A bunch of black youth, black and Hispanic youth all over the city were pulled in for questioning at different precincts. Anyway, he said that they spent hours there, you know, before their parents were called. His grandmother did call, but he said she had either limited English, and she was trying to understand what they were saying. But at the time, she was thinking this is something minimal, like trespassing or something like that. They would have her go out of the room. They would say, "Hey, we want to talk to you out of the room." And then they would pour on this intense pressure on him. And basically, the five of them said they were basically coerced. The ones who confessed, Raymond Santana was one of those who confessed to the crime. Eventually, he said they kind of put words in his mouth and made them think that other people had said this. And so they were thinking, "Hey, we just want to get out of here, you know." And one of them, a couple of them, when I was watching the miniseries, had said that they felt like they might be killed or something. You know, the police were, you know, all powerful in their minds. And so they were scared. He was scared. And so he did end up confessing. By the time his dad came, got off work and everything, all that had happened. They didn't have legal representation or anything. Like I said, they were minors. So anyway, his message to the community was that, hey, he survived. He survived it. He did. I want to say he said after being in jail before the trial and all that kind of stuff, and then going through, he was in a juvenile detention facility for about 7 years. So 7 years of his life he spent detained, and, you know, he can't get that back. He was one of the people who fought very hard to get the truth to come out, that they did not do this. One of the things that's real interesting is that they were offered a plea deal, but they all said after they figured out, okay, hey, you know we didn't do this, we shouldn't have said we did, they were offered a plea deal, and they might have gotten a lesser sentence, but they didn't, because they said they were innocent. So guess what? You know, they got the book thrown at them. Anyway, he just talked about that. And his message to the crowd was, you know, never give up. Never give up, no matter what people say. He said that for years after this, because they were convicted of that horrible crime, you know, people, you know, hated them. The people on the street, as soon as they found out, you know, who they were, you know, it was hard to get a job. You know, this whole idea of the media at the time called them super predators, a wolf pack, and the term wilding. I've looked it up, and from what I understand, it was coined at that time. But then there are other instances where people said, no, this had been a word before then. But I remember myself being a young adult then and hearing that word wilding. It's basically like a violent attack, you know, a frenzied animal-like attack and everything. So you can imagine, you get out of jail, you've served your time or what have you, and they're saying that you did this, and, you know, you didn't. So he said it was really, really hard. But he now does work with the Innocence Project, and he really wants people to pay attention to criminal justice reform.
Right, and I want to ask you about that. But first, did he, during his talk, describe the level of relief that he and the others experienced when they were finally acquitted of that attack?
I'm trying to think. He didn't really talk about that, but you got the sense when he was talking about Here's what he did say, though. And Gary Jones, who is the assistant dean of students at OC, he kind of led into this with his question. He said, so you were exonerated, but did that mean you were free? And that's how Raymond Santana got into it, because he said, no, we weren't. We were exonerated, but we weren't free. For one thing, he told us that a lot of media outlets did not really cover the exoneration like they did the trial. So a lot of people didn't know, you know, if that's where they were getting their information. They didn't know that they had been exonerated, and they didn't know to the level. You know, here was someone who's the man who came forward, his DNA matched it, the things that he said about the scene, that it all matched. It corroborated the evidence that they had. So they were exonerated, like, fully. And their convictions were overturned. So this was a big deal. And yet they had spent a lot of their life under this huge, you know, cloud of shame and you know, criminality. So he said they weren't really, really free from that. And so that's why what they're doing, at least he is, going around talking to different people about criminal justice reform, about how there's so many parts of the criminal justice system that need to be overhauled, mm-hmm. or need to be looked at. And he encouraged the college kids there, college students there, to use their education, you know, for good, you know, to be lawyers and judges and you know, lobbyists, people who can maybe do some things to help in this effort.
Yeah, and what is the Innocence Project, just for listeners? What is that?
The Innocence Project, from what I understand, it's a team of people who come together to look into the cases of those who are incarcerated, to look at maybe some of the finer details, to see if they deserve a chance for a new trial to so that can show that they're innocent. And, you know, they have shown a lot of people are innocent over the years. You know, I'd be interested to know what the percentage is, but even if it's just one person, you know, and a lot of those people that are acquitted or they had their convictions overturned through the Innocence Project, they've already spent years and years in jail. So you can imagine, if you're a kid, you know, going through that, and then their families. That was one of the things that the miniseries talked about, and Raymond Santana talked about it too, about, you know, his family and all the things they had to go through because of this, the trial and the convictions and everything.
Yeah. Well, Carla, that sounds like a fascinating talk for you to get to hear, and we appreciate you covering the event and telling us about it. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I have to say, it was one of the more interesting things I've been able to cover in a long time.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can read all these stories and more every day in the Oklahoman and at oklahoman.com. Check back next Friday for a new episode.